Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So here's your opportunity, folks, to hear commentary, analysis, and perhaps even a little bit of insight into the media issues of the week. We hope to offer you our best, and generally we fail to deliver, but we'll do what we can.
And you got an awful lot of starch in your shirt, Rex. It's going to stand up and walk away.
Well, any insults in here, it may, with me in it. So there.
You know, I've been liberated since I decided not to wear a tie anymore.
Yeah.
That, there's nothing like wearing that tie and that tight collar all day. It's hot, and you know, you're hot under the collar all day as it is. But when you take that tie off, it changes your whole outlook.
But it's part,
on night.
It's part of the trend too for your cool new company. You know,
I don't know. I'm not sure, but I feel like I should be in the cutting edge. You know, they yeah. call me the Jimmy Fallon of Kingston. Well, no, actually, they don't. They call him the Jimmy Fallon of Saugerties. But
Ira Fussfeld from the Daily Freeman of Kingston. That would be Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, and I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. This is The Media Project. You know, actually, let's start off by talking about sports, because Ira, you began your career as a sports writer.
I have.
Noted sports guy. And there was this amazing incident in which if you look at the video that has gone viral of this coach at where?
Rutgers, a state university in New Jersey.
Where I started to teach. That was my first.
Hasn't been the same since.
No, yes, apparently not.
And as I understand it, the basketball coach, the program on ESPN called Outside the Lines, which is one of their better efforts. ESPN can't be proud of a lot of things, but this they can be proud of. It's an investigative
ESPN
program.
Is a Hearst company. I think
they
can be proud of quite a lot.
I thought they were a Disney company.
both. Yes, we have.
Anyway, ESPN did an expose about this coach showing video, and it was more than one video. It was a number of occurrences spliced together of the basketball coach running practice and just losing his temper, to say the least, throwing balls at people, pushing people, putting their arms at people, using homophobic slurs. And this apparently occurred many months ago and was unreported. And the coach at the time received a 3-game suspension and a $75,000 fine.
I thought it was 50, but who knows?
And now, as a result of the ESPN report, which aired on a Tuesday, by Tuesday afternoon, the video had gone viral, as they say. All of the other media outlets picked it up. And by Wednesday morning, the coach had been fired, and deservedly so. I think most people would agree. And the question from a media standpoint is, how come this was so much a secret all this time? Did you mean to tell me that the beat reporters didn't know of this kind of behavior on the part of the coach? Or when the coach was suspended originally, and again, I didn't Google it and look up old stories, but was there an attempt to find out why was he suspended, or did they just merely pass it off as a personnel decision and couldn't talk about it? So
do you have a suspicion that the beat reporter might have been protecting his relationship with the coach?
I think it's possible one of two things: that the beat reporters either didn't do a good enough job and didn't ask the right questions, or that perhaps they too thought it was part of the job. Here's a tough guy coach, and you know, look what happened with Bobby Knight. Bobby Knight made a career about, you know, being a rough guy who pushed his players around and gave them tough love. And maybe reporters there felt this was just part of being a major college coach. But the ball was dropped somewhere.
You know, the question of the new media now, of digital media being able to take things viral and giving people more accountability, is raised whenever you see this. Same thing happened this past week with a judge in Alabama. Alabama, who apparently had a camera going in his courtroom over his shoulder, a family court judge, and he flipped out at a husband in a marital dispute and screamed obscenities at him and threatened him, basically. The judge is now suspended, but it does raise a couple of questions. One of them is, how long had this kind of behavior been going on in his courtroom, and what might we not know about courtrooms where cameras are barred, as they are in much of the country, much of New York State at least, still?
Including the Supreme Court, which is just, you know, after the recent Supreme Court business on gay marriage, again, we finally heard the voices. They are now releasing the tapes, but why can't that be on live TV? This is the world we live in now. These things ought to be televised.
And it changes behavior. That's Rex's point, your point. You know, if a guy's sitting in a courtroom and screaming, as in, you know, my cousin Vinny. Remember my cousin Vinny?
Hey, yeah. That was great.
Joe Pesci. That right.
These youths.
The youths.
But you know, obviously, if you know you're on television, one day, just for the hell of it, I was bored back in the day, and I brought a legal pad and a pencil into the courtroom in Great Barrington. And I just wanted to be amused, to be honest with you. But I, you know, they knew who I was, and the bailiff came up and said, "Judge would like to talk to you."
You're not allowed to take notes,
well,
or do they think that you
were... I obviously spooked him. And judge would like to talk to you. So I went into the back room with the judge, and he said, "Alan, is there anything I can..." And he's a sweet man. "Is there anything I can be helpful with?" And I said, "No, actually, I just decided it would be a good day to come in and see what was going on, you know, over here." And I could see a noticeable sort of relief on his part. The real question, of course, for all of us is, are reporters or others only out to get you? Because I could just as have easily, I needed a column, said, "A good day in the Great Barrington Court, a nice judge, he's passed now," and he was a nice guy, "and here's how justice is meted out." But somebody with a pencil and a pad caused a certain amount of consternation.
Well, you know, the argument about not having cameras in courts, in lower courts or in criminal court cases, was that it might, you know, expose witnesses to publicity that they don't want to be a part of, and all of those things. But at the Supreme Court level, nobody is going to play to the cameras in the Supreme Court. The judges are listening. They don't have to be elected. They're there. And the lawyers know better than to screw around in the Supreme Court. So what would the harm be of having Supreme Court arguments videoed?
Well, I'll tell you what they would say is the harm. They would say that it would increase public pressure on the court, which needs to be above it all. That is, the court holds itself as something special rather than being simply the smallest legislature in the country.
Which it is.
In effect, yes, absolutely. I mean, with all due respect to folks at the bar who are going to complain about this, but
in fact,
it's a 9-member legislature that is making ultimate judgments about the constitutionality of what goes on in our country.
And often, Rex, to keep the pressure off the Congress, who are the elected people. So when some of these things are just too hot to handle and you can't get it done, they bring it to the court. For example, you know, Baker versus Carr, Westbury versus Sanders. You know, these are all the one man, one vote cases. And also, integration in the United States, which was never going through that Congress with that filibuster in the Senate. So it does substantiate your point. It is a small legislature.
And the people have the right to have a true vision of it, a clear understanding of it, and that understanding would be enhanced by having cameras there. I mean, we're, of course, you know, I've represented the print media primarily. We do digital, we do video, but primarily we're a print medium, and so we can tell the stories, but people really will get more.
Well, I mean, the fact is that we are allowed, we, the press, is allowed in, and the public is allowed in. In rare instances, there are closed courtrooms, but you can get in to see the Supreme Court in action. So they're not working in privacy, and the cameras should just not... I mean, the cameras are part of our lives now. 150 years ago, there was no way that these proceedings could be televised. Now there is a way, and they should be.
Yeah. I had a whole different feeling about Justice Kennedy in the last round when we heard the voices. I liked him. He sounded like a reasonable fellow, and I didn't know that. And if you take a look at a Clarence Thomas, for example, who up to now I have not liked for his conservative stances and going along with whatever the court does, I'd like to hear what he has to say.
Unfortunately,
he never says anything.
Maybe the cameras would get him going.
Now, speaking of cameras present, we had quite a spectacle in New York State recently, of course, with the early morning arrest, the pre-dawn hours arrest of State Senator Malcolm Smith down in Queens. Interestingly enough, two newspapers had photographers there on site as he answered the door in his pajamas. The New York Times and the New York Post were both there. Interesting.
Now, you had a term for that, Rex, which I really loved, but I forgot. What is it?
Well, I said they were given good room service. basically, that's...
room service by the either the federal prosecutor or the FBI.
Yeah.
Working
hand in hand, they would. And so, and this happens to all of us. We have arrangements with sources who will give us information sometimes, but it is just for those of us who are not lucky enough to get that room service, you know.
You get angry.
Well, let's talk about that. What do you suppose the relationship was between those media and these officials so that they were able to have people there?
My guess is that reporters, the beat reporters in those situations found out that this investigation was going on and that the sources they were dealing with said to them, took them in and said, listen, wait a minute, don't blow this investigation for us. Don't write about this. You can be there when we take down our target if you will not write about this now.
I agree with that possibility, because I know we have experienced that with police matters, lesser police matters than arrest of a state senator. And I can recall one famous case in the Kingston area where they tipped us off on a raid so that we could be there for the raid. So,
And the perp walk, of course, we know that. You know, we're going to walk them during this time. But you know what? If you extrapolate that, that's a big word for you guys. But if you extrapolate...
How do you spell that?
But if you extrapolate...
PhD.
But if you extrapolate to... the Kennedy invasion of Cuba and say, okay, please don't write about this because you'll ruin it. Well, if they had written about it, maybe he wouldn't have done it, and maybe this fiasco wouldn't have happened. So this business of please shut up and we'll pay you off later on has a certain tint to something that's not quite right.
I don't disagree with that. Wasn't Scotty Reston famously, after in his memoirs, said he was asked to hold up on that?
On that, yeah.
On Bay of Pigs.
And I think you make a good point, but boy, you don't want to be the journalist who's responsible for blowing a major investigation by the DA. We have a terrific reporter in our Times Union newsroom, Brendan Lyons, who has frequently found material. A few years ago, he discovered that there was an investigation underway into steroid use into a major pharmaceutical supplier in Florida. And he and a photographer actually flew down there to Florida so they could be there when the raid took place. And he had information that the prosecutors even didn't have. Based upon his reporting, he was able to report in the Times Union the next day about people who are customers of this pharmaceutical manufacturing plant, athletes and dancers and the like. The other reporters here in the Capital Region were very annoyed that the Times Union had all this information, assumed that it had been fed to us by the prosecutors. In fact, this was hard groundwork done by our reporter getting this stuff. And so sometimes it's not just a relationship with a source. It's just really good, hard-hitting reporting that leads them to the same place at the same time.
And so I'm cynical. I've always thought investigative reporting means that some guy calls you up on the telephone and says, here's what.
If only. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, sometimes that happens. But more often than not, I mean, I've had a situation of somebody just, you get something over the transom. We had a very big piece of political information a few days before an election some years ago that literally came to me in a brown envelope without markings. And I had my suspicions of who had provided it to me in the political world. But it was confirming information that our reporting had previously uncovered, but we hadn't been able to confirm, and we finally had documents as a result of this brown envelope that confirmed involving former Congressman John Sweeney. And so this was a remarkable thing. And so sometimes you get gifts like this. But
the other thing about this New York case, the recent New York case, is print can still do something that, at least to my mind, is dramatic and striking. And it's not, in this case, necessarily the front pages of the two tabloids, but in the New York Times coverage of the day after the Smith arrest.
State
Senator Malcolm Smith.
Yeah, yeah.
They had a inside the paper, four rows of pictures, headshots, 20 pictures in all. And these were 20 of the 29 people in New York state government who had been involved with either corruption or arrest or something like that. But to pick up the New York Times, and there are 20 public officials who have violated the public trust, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I just thought it was just a striking layout. It was plain. There was nothing fancy about it, but it was dramatic.
And but very quickly, because I know Rex wants to move on with still more important
subjects.
Quite all
right. Quite all right.
But
we haven't talked about the Times Union.
But you know, this is really where a newspaper can make a major difference in terms of analysis. We've done a lot of that here on public radio, but Here comes this schnook, alleged schnook, Malcolm Smith, former Democratic leader in the Senate, who wants to buy his way into the mayoral nomination in New York. You can't run.
Can't make it up.
You can't run unless they give you a Wilson Pakula, which is a document saying you're allowed to run in a party that you don't belong to. But the real truth is, in this whole big story of this guy who has to be an idiot if that's what he was trying to do, is this is really the gang who couldn't shoot straight. This is really stupid stuff. But every day in the legislature, people give immense amounts of money to somebody, and they put it in their campaign. Nobody ever says into a microphone like this one, if you do this, I'll do that, because that's illegal. So they just give them the money. That's the real corruption in Albany.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. And the problem is, it's hard. The only way you can do that within the strictures of straight journalism, which we practice, is to put two facts alongside each other. You can't say, except on opinion pages, what you just said, that that's the corruption in Albany.
Well, you can if you get somebody else's voice. See, that's my theory of the F sharp.
That's right.
If you go to Barbara Bartoletti of the League of Women Voters and say, okay, we're doing a story on political corruption, or to Alan Chartok, which almost never happens in the Times Union, but if you were to go to them, they would say, you press the F sharp, you get the F sharp.
Absolutely. You know, we have had examples. We know of a legislative leader who, on the phone talking to a lobbyist about a bill, will say, by the way, have you bought any tickets to the fundraiser? Those are $10,000 tickets, you know. And, you know, what is the clear inference that that lobbyist draws from that? He's not saying, I will pass this bill, I will let this bill move right to the floor of the state Senate if you buy these tickets. But that's the clear inference. And that is more corrupt, I would say, than what Malcolm Smith was doing. Because for Malcolm Smith, it was just for his personal aggrandizement. In the other case, it's actually corrupting the legislative process by extra legal means. It's ridiculous.
And now I know, and maybe we even talked about this last week, but there was a remarkable picture in one of the papers the other day, which showed Alphonse D'Amato surrounded by two mafioso, one of whose head ended up in the back compartment of a car.
Goodness.
You take a look at that and you say, holy moly. You don't need a big story.
Well, and the other thing regarding Albany and corruption, and this doesn't come under the heading of corruption, but again, it comes under the heading of the public's right to know, as it's either directly or through the media, and that is the recent conclusion of the budget negotiations. Now, for the third year in a row, New York State passed a budget on time after two decades of not
big
passing
spiel.
It. And during those two decades, that's when the word dysfunction came up and was repeated, and the legislature was constantly vilified for not getting the budget passed on time. Now, for the last 3 years, the budget was passed on time. But again, this most recent one was largely the product of overnight closed-door negotiations between, is it the big three or the big four now?
Actually, it's the big one.
It's the big one.
It's only one guy
and,
who
and
counts
so,
anymore.
So the Gannett News Service does an interview with Senator Liebes from Binghamton. And they asked the question, you've been criticized by good government groups for the manner in which this budget was negotiated in private. And Liebes says, and I'm quoting him fairly accurately now, they complained when we were too late, and now they're complaining that we're early, and we did it the right way, and those good government groups ought to go get a job, or, you know, something to that. Well, wait a minute. They are doing the work of the state of New York in private, and they're keeping most people in the state of New York, including many of their members, in the dark until the last minute. And why does this continue to happen? Because the only people who complain about it are those people who write editorials or the people who do commentaries on the radio. And the public in the districts keep electing these people back into office.
And that's where Rex's point that he always makes about citizen journalism, mm-hmm. about letting people know what the real story is, becomes so important. I mean, these guys are paid an immense amount of money. And what do? They do their job for 3 years in a row. They never did it before. Somebody's got to say, big deal, who cares? You know, you're doing your job. You're not supposed to get a confetti parade down Broadway for this.
Here's a difficulty with the structure of what we do. In an instance like this, where you have words of praise being sung by every player in the process, the only voices raising a question about it are small voices on the sidelines. As you say, the good government groups, journalists, a few folks like that. And it is outweighed by the overarching voices of the governor, the speaker, the majority, or whatever used to be called the majority leader. And that is really just it's a structural problem, actually, that you would think that the rise of digital journalism, the multitude of voices that can come through the internet ought to combat. Maybe it will over time.
But not if you have only one night to do it in. I think Ira's point is exactly that. You know, if it was a long, extended process, somebody would figure something out and put it on the internet. That this deal is being arrived at, or the rest, or a picture of a United States senator with two mafioso would be there. But the fact is that when you do it in one night, you haven't got the opportunity for the digital media.
Well, but the other issue here is that the legislators individually are very popular in their districts. They keep getting reelected, largely because of the jerry-rigged gerrymander system. Yeah. And so when a popular legislator in the district hears the criticism of their local media or of a broader media regarding the process, and they say, in effect, the media doesn't know what they're talking about, they're only out to get us. Yeah. The media's reputation, unfortunately, is such that the constituents of the legislator are inclined to believe them, because we're not very popular.
You know, I don't know. I'm on this program in the morning with Joe Donahue, and he'll ask a question, and we'll get very few calls on anything having to do with state government.
Mm-hmm.
You ask about the football scores or who's doing well in baseball and, you know, in the music, and everybody's there. But I think people have opted out, and therefore it's not as an attractive proposition to do well.
But it depends what it is. Look at the reaction to the gun law, look at the reaction in advance to the fracking issue. I mean, there are isolated issues.
Oh, no, that's
But the
true.
Day-to-day budget, most people glaze over until they get their tax bill.
Yeah.
Quotes of the week. Tina Brown, the editor-in-chief of Daily Beast / Newsweek. Newsweek, of course, is no longer in print. It's just digital. Tina Brown used to be the editor of The New Yorker. She's a remarkable journalist, analyst of things. She says that the business aspect of journalism is more challenging than her love for journalism, and she says that problem is widespread. Listen to this. She says, we're living in a time when everybody's so obsessed with delivery systems and gaming the system and, you know, business. It's actually very, very soul-destroying. We don't have enough respect for content anymore. In the end, without the great content, there are no numbers. You see again and again in the media this obsession with the numbers, this obsession with the audiences, with the demo, etc. But without the talent, without the people who do it, your company's worth nothing.
And I'm sure she gets a lot of applause when she says that. But that's the reality.
That's right. I mean, my tendency is to agree with her because the content should be king. But the fact is, we're in this transitional period, not only from print to digital, but, you know, within print itself. And there are so many financial pressures that it's very easy for us to be concentrating more on that than on content. And that's I'm not advocating it, but that's what's going on.
It is the reality. I spend a lot more time dealing with business side issues as an editor than I ever did initially or than I ever imagined I would.
Give us an example very quickly.
Well, I'm just saying like how to book the paper so that you have an appropriate mix of advertising. Well, this morning we've got an ad on the front page of a split. That is the section is divided in two, and the front page of the second half of the A section is an ad. And I think you need to have editorial content there or else people don't know that. Or how to, you know, I'm worried about.
And you had a fight about that.
The appropriate mix of news hole is an issue. I need more news hole. I need more space in the paper. But, you know, the amount of news hole is something that I'm constantly negotiating and arguing about.
I know about that because when I ran the Fire Island Sun 5,000 years ago, as the publisher, we didn't have enough ads. And the editor didn't have enough content.
Yeah.
So you used to take tiny little ads and make them into half-page ads. Because he was the
special bonus for advertisers. Your ad gets blown up.
I always used to like listening to radio and music, AM radio music stations, when they say, and now upcoming a half hour of commercial-free music.
Right, right.
And I'm thinking, well, they're not doing anybody any favors. They just don't have any commercials.
I don't understand how, well, that's in a whole other topic. I don't understand how that enterprise is supported.
Because the people make $10 a day.
Oh, I was going to say, Dave Gillette used to say, a dollar a holler.
All right, that's enough for the Media Project for this week. Ira Fussfeld, Alan Chartok, and Rex Smith here. You can join us, media@wamc.org. You can listen to this program anytime at wamc.org. Thanks for joining us on the Media Project.
But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people when they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim...